my name is Priya Subramanian, and I'm a current student of physical therapy at Regis University, and I'm with Ira Gorman, our associate dean of the program. Ira, can you just tell us a little bit about how you got first involved with the Regis physical therapy program, and then specifically your advocacy for health policy?
Okay, Priya, thank you. As said, my name is Ira Gorman. I'm the assistant dean and associate professor. I've been at Regis since the beginning of our program back in 1995. So I became interested in Regis because there was a talk about developing a new program in Colorado, and I was recruited to be a part of that. And very happy that I was able to be on the ground level and help develop the program, first as a master's program, and then 6 years later when we went to the DPT. And I've been here since and teaching a number of different classes, including health policy, which is my interest. How I became interested in that, well, that goes way back to my days in New York. My father was a big union leader, so I was always interested in politics and benefits and policy. So I always had a kind of political interest from a very young age, being involved in elections and things like that. So when I went to PT school, I had a lot of questions about not just, you know, providing care, but how it was going to be paid for.
Right.
And so I merged that political interest with my clinical interest. I then went on to get a master's in public health after PT school. And so that also kind of made me more interested in health policy.
Right.
And so, you know, I just think it's important because it's what we do. And it's not just providing care, but how we're going to get paid, or even more important, how the care is going to be sustainable.
Right.
You know, so it's not just about money, although that's important. we are providing a service and we need to be compensated for it. And it needs to be fair and equitable for the providers as well, as well as the clients and patients. But we also have to have a system that is equitable and fair to everybody, so everybody gets care, and that's why I became very involved in that. I think also as PTs become better understanding of how the insurance system or healthcare system in our country works, maybe it will lead to less frustration. And
I
mean, I think initially lead to more frustration as you see how complicated it is. But as you understand something, then you're better positioned to try to improve it and how to change it. So I think that will be really valuable for everybody.
And obviously that health policy is definitely integrated into the curriculum here. But outside of just our regular classwork, do you have suggestions for any students who are interested in getting involved more so on the advocacy end?
So the first thing is to, again, educate yourself about it. So, you know, reading blogs, reading, I hate to say newspapers, I still do, watching TV.
Right.
But, you know, it's just staying attuned to what's going on in health policy and what changes are being recommended. I also think it's important for students and PTs to be involved in the political system as far as knowing who your representatives are, knowing how to contact them, whether they're at the state or federal level, and knowing when to reach out to them. Now, the APTA offers a great service. They have a legislative advocacy page. They have a contact page where you can register and you can find out who your members of Congress are and how to reach out to them. And so there's an app for that, and then there's the website of APTA, and that can kind of tie you in. It's also at the local level. Each state has a government affairs committee. In Colorado, we have a group that meets during the session, which starts in January, and students and PTs are invited to get involved in that. And we have a day at the Capitol, and we also have a day in Washington, D.C. And so if you're really interested in it, you can dive headfirst into it and as deep as you want. But I think it's just being up to date on information and staying with the people that do represent you, whether they're on the Government Affairs Committee, the board as such, and, you know, and getting information from them.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a point where a lot of students struggle, is coming in not knowing very much and wanting to make a change, but not knowing where to begin and how to enter a system that's so complicated.
Being an advocate just means being informed and then taking steps to do something about it. And that could be as simple as making a phone call to a representative or a member of Congress, or writing a letter, or just going to a rally or a meeting or things like that. So.
Absolutely. So currently, what do you think are some of the biggest problems with our healthcare system, and just maybe some ideas about how PTs could better advocate for those patients and provide the best care possible within a system that is unfortunately sometimes very limiting.
So since we don't have like 2 weeks to talk about this, the biggest problem I see in our healthcare system is that it's very complex and it's, I believe, inequitable. In other words, it's not very fair. There are some people who have access to a lot of care and then a lot of people who do not have access to care, either because they live in a rural area, they don't have insurance, or they don't have a financial means, even if they have insurance. There's people who are uninsured, but there's also people what we call underinsured, where they have insurance, but their copays, deductibles, cost sharing is so high that it actually prevents people from getting care. Mm-hmm. If you have to pay $50 a copay 3 times a week for PT,
you won't be doing it, right?
So, you know, those are the type of barriers, and it really varies, you know, and our system is complex, but it's also inconsistent. You know, again, I always like to say some people get too much care, some people get too little care, and it's not distributed equally across. So the biggest thing is to try to come up with a system that provides basic care to everybody. And so that's why I think we need some type of universal health care. Now, I may personally believe in a single-payer system and studied it in other countries. But that may not be what everybody wants. But there has to be some way to deliver care across the board so that we don't have 15% of individuals that are uninsured. Now, Colorado has done quite well under the Affordable Care Act because our marketplace exchanges have worked pretty good, and we've done the Medicaid expansion. So the uninsured rate in Colorado has gone down from 16% to 9% since the Affordable Care Act, but that's still hundreds of thousands of people in Colorado who don't have insurance, and it's still millions of people across the country who don't have insurance. So there has to be some way to either improve the current system under the Affordable Care Act or come up with a different system that it basically includes everybody. I think if we include everybody, we can share the risk and the expense across the board. It's also a benefit for physical therapists because then everybody will be insured, and that's just more customers. And we saw that when it happened at the Affordable Care Act. When the Medicaid expansion went into effect, hospitals got busier because more people had insurance. Clinics got busier. So it can only help us as providers. We'll provide more care to more people, but we'll also have more business.
More comprehensive, right?
Yeah. So I think that's the biggest thing. And again, how can PTs, I think, it could just be part of the discussion and educate our patients why it's important. If they say their copays are too high or they don't have insurance to come in for PT, well, then they need to write their, again, members of Congress and see if we can change the system, you know. I mean, there are minor ways and, you know, cash-based practices and depending where you work and what kind of benefits are. But I think the biggest way to do legislative advocacy is for people to get involved and follow. We have an election coming up next year, and there'll be a lot of news coming out about healthcare.
So I think that's definitely one place that physical therapists have unfortunately lagged behind, is just being, you know, a major force inside the healthcare discussion and not just not really advocating even for themselves, right? So people still don't fully know what physical therapy is and what it can do for patients, and so that's sometimes it's not at the forefront of people's minds as a first,
first choice for care. We're also, in the big picture of it, we're a small part of the healthcare dollar,
you know,
between 3% and 6%. So sometimes we always think we're getting picked on too much, you know, for the amount of impact we have in the healthcare. But when it becomes certain people, especially seniors and Medicare, well, then it goes up a little bit more because we play a large role in that. But across the whole spectrum, I mean, there are much bigger fish
to
be concerned with. Hospital costs, pharmaceuticals, you know, surgery, physicians. Physicians and hospitals eat up about 50% of the healthcare dollar.
Yeah.
Again, we're 3% to 6% of it. So, it's hard, but to us it's very important. And to our patients it's very important. The thing, you made a good point about people don't understand or know what physical therapy is, but the people who do come to physical therapy learn about it, and they like physical therapists. And I mean, we have a very positive patient satisfaction. People like us. They like what we do. They perceive that we help people. And so the people that we do touch have a very good experience.
They're our biggest advocates.
Exactly.
There you go, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you touched on this a little bit, but so why do you believe that there's been an influx in cash-only services in physical therapy? And do you think there is a, you know, most effective way to distribute services to the communities that we do serve?
So that's a very good question, and it's very important and very timely, and it's also something I tend to have a very passionate response to.
Mm-hmm.
So right off the bat, I would say I'm not... Well, first, let's say, why is there an increase in cash flow? Because copays have gotten so high that when you're paying $50, $60 as a copay, you can almost pay cash for the visit, you know. So
right.
We used to say that insurance would cover 80% and you would cover 20%. So if the visit cost $100, your insurance would pay $80 and you'd pay $20.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the typical copay years ago. Well, now it's flipped the other way around.
Right.
So if the visit costs $100, your insurance pays $10 and you pay $90, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So you're paying so much of it, sometimes it's easier to just go without insurance and just pay cash. So I think
Absolutely.
People are doing that. And for providers and consumers, it just gets rid of all the craziness, the complication. It's like, okay, I'll just
pay
for this.
So many different steps in between.
Right.
Yeah.
Or, you know, now you see Groupons, you know,
right.
and people get discounts, and you see it more for chiropractic and massage, but and acupuncture, but, you know, physical therapy as well. So
mm-hmm.
that's a good side to it. There's a consumer. I know people talk a lot about personal responsibility, and if people are paying for something, then they're more likely to appreciate the service
mm-hmm.
and to more to follow your instructions and those type of things. So that's all the good side of it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, the reason why I'm hesitant about it is that then we become a service that's only available to people who can pay for it.
Right.
And because of my strong interest in social justice and being that healthcare is a right, I believe, and
mm-hmm.
it should be distributed to everybody, I don't want us to become just a cash-based practice like chiropractic and things like that.
Right.
I think we need to be part of health plans. We need to be part of Medicare and Medicaid, and we need to be an affordable service under that. And therefore, then everybody should get it. If it just becomes cash pay, you know, what are all the poor people going to do? What are kids, you know, who have chronic disability
right.
and who are born with problems and need lifelong care?
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to pay for that? So I see both sides of it. I see the consumer side, the business side. I think cash pay has advantages to some people in some communities. But across the board, I don't see it as good social policy because it's not fair.
Right. Absolutely.
Medicaid, you asked about. And,
yes.
you know, Medicaid has actually been very beneficial to physical therapy. I mean, Medicaid doesn't pay well to hospitals and physicians. But actually,
mm-hmm.
when it comes to physical therapy outpatient services, Medicaid is not bad. And we've seen that in Colorado. So Medicaid expansion has been a good thing for physical therapy, I believe, across
mm-hmm.
the country and especially in Colorado. The Medicaid rates are close to the Medicare rates, a little bit lower,
mm-hmm.
but they tend to be higher than some of the commercial insurance rates.
Okay.
So there are, you know, prior authorization needed and to become a Medicaid provider, but the payment can be quicker. Now, it's subject to state funding, and sometimes we've seen a decrease in state funding and the Medicaid rates go down, but
right.
Colorado recently expanded the Medicaid rates. So I just think you have to look at it, you know, not as a blanket statement where people think, oh, Medicaid is awful because, you know, you assume that you don't get paid as much. But one, it's better than not getting paid at all. And actually, if you really look at it closely, in Colorado, Medicaid is a good program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very comprehensive. It covers equipment. It covers services, PT services, rehab, OT, speech. So for, you know, especially children, again, with chronic disability, Medicaid is a very good service, and I'd like to see it improved rather than discarded.
Absolutely. And for people who aren't super familiar with Medicaid, who are the most common individuals included on that plan?
Yeah. So Medicaid is a social program that's available for people with low income,
mm-hmm.
you know, certain percentage of the poverty level. And poverty level is decided each year in different states. So usually about $28,000 for a family of four, about $8,000 to $10,000 for an individual.
Okay.
So if you are below 133% of the poverty level, then you become eligible for Medicaid. Medicaid was a program for low income individuals and especially single mothers and children.
Mm-hmm.
And recently it was being expanded. But to cover the rest of the family, but it's still mainly single mothers and children that are covered under Medicaid. Okay. Also people with chronic disabilities, so people who are injured and become Medicare and Medicaid coverage. So
I see. So workers' comp?
Not workers' comp, but from people with who had strokes or brain injuries and children who were born with disabilities and those type of things. So the other thing is there are certain people with certain categories of renal failure and things like that that can get coverage, and people that are blind. So but Medicaid is pretty much a low income, what I call a transfer payment. You know, people who make money working pay taxes, and that money goes to cover people who are not working and poor on Medicaid. Some people like to call it a welfare program. I don't like that term. I think it's a pejorative, but it's a transfer payment program.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you were saying the Medicaid program seems to be a bit more comprehensive in Colorado and some states. Why is there that discrepancy?
Well, because commercial insurance don't cover, you know, durable medical equipment like walkers and braces and wheelchairs sometimes. It depends on the insurance plan, but Medicaid does cover that. I think, again, because those things were very costly for individuals. So once you were giving health care, especially to children with disabilities, you needed to be comprehensive and to cover those things.
Right.
And they also cover medications and things like that. So the Medicaid program, again, is a good program. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem sometimes with physicians and hospitals is some places don't accept Medicaid. So access is a problem. And there are physical therapists who don't accept Medicaid as well. But I really believe we should try to improve get more clinics on the Medicaid program and make them understand that the reimbursement is really not that bad compared to other payers.
Which is just an education piece.
Yeah, I think so.
Right.
Yeah, there's a stigma associated with Medicaid.
Mm-hmm. Currently, how many for like freestanding PT clinics do you think even accept Medicaid?
You know, I don't know that, but I think there's more, you know, because some of the networks that have formed in Colorado of PT clinics have now had Medicaid contracts. And I think, again, since the Affordable Care Act and the exchanges, the other thing we're seeing is that there's more people on Medicaid, so people are interested, including students.
Right.
I'm very, you know, happy to share. We have students who are at Regis who are on Medicaid. And so it's not just means that you're destitute and poor. You're a student. You're low income. And this is a program that's worth purchasing into through the exchanges. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing more people on Medicaid, and I think that might get more clinics involved, too.
All right.
I hope it expands.
I hope so, too. So I think we've already talked a little bit. Did we talk about Health First Colorado?
Well, Health First Colorado is one of the Medicaid
plans
through the exchange. Mm-hmm. So there's different terms, you know, and there's also the Child Health Plan in Colorado. And nationally it's called CHIP, S-C-H-I-P, but in Colorado it's CHP. Okay. So Health First is just another program through the exchanges that's a Medicaid plan that you can purchase into.
I see.
Yeah.
So many different terms. So of some of the recent developments that have happened in our healthcare system, do you think there are some that are more so beneficial to patients and practitioners, some that, you know, patients might not even know have happened?
So clearly, just the expansion again of services, you know, Medicaid expansion, the exchanges is a positive thing. And it lets more people get access to care and to use insurance before they turn 65, where there's Medicare. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge piece of the Affordable Care Act. The other piece was that they did away with pre-existing conditions. So before that, if you signed up for an insurance plan and you hurt your knee a few years ago, they might say, well, we'll cover all your injuries and illnesses, but we're not going to cover anything to do with your right knee because you had hurt that before. It was pre-existing. So the Affordable Care Act did away with that. They also did away with caps, so lifetime caps. So let's say you bought an insurance plan and it had a $250,000 cap. It sounds like a lot, but it's not.
Condition like cancer, it could easily exactly. surpass that.
Yeah, and even just a knee operation, you mm-hmm. know, ACL can cost you $100,000, mm-hmm. you know, not you personally, but the insurance. So the cap can get used up very quickly. Right. So they did away with that. They basically said if you buy insurance and it's going to cover you for as long as you are on that insurance plan, no matter what it costs.
Okay.
Now, there always are restrictions of what they cover and how much and there's medical review and things like that. But to just have these blanket caps and pre-existing conditions, these barriers were done away with in the Affordable Care Act. The other big change was the allowing children to stay on their parents' insurance until age 26 before it was 21. And again, students, that's a big deal because Absolutely. You're still in school. You're in graduate school. You're not working. So, right, you had to go on Medicaid or if your parents still had insurance. And personally, yes, I have two children who are still on my insurance, and I'm mm-hmm. glad that. So those were very good changes and developments. Again, in Colorado, there was an adjustment to the Medicaid rates. That was good. Even the Medicare rates went up a little bit across the country. So there have been some positive things that way. Detrimental, well, the biggest thing we're seeing is this cost shifting or the increase in copays, mm-hmm. coinsurance, and deductibles. You know, where the typical, when I was starting my career, copays were $5, $10, $20, deductibles were $100. Well, now copays are $50, $60, deductibles are could be $1,000. So
steers you from even going to your primary exactly, care physician right. or regular checkups.
Yeah, or you go get a prescription, and right. instead of paying $20 for the medicine, you have to pay $100. So those type of things, it's pushing the burden, the cost sharing, onto the patient from the insurance company or the employer. Premiums have gone up. There's no mm-hmm. question about it. Now, I don't think the Affordable Care Act was a cause of that, but they would have gone up anyway, and I think they went up less because of that. Mm-hmm. And again, the biggest problem is if everybody's not insured, then you have fewer people to share the risk of. The more people in the program, the easier it is to spread the cost, and that's why I think we need to cover everybody in some type of universal health care. And then the other big thing I'm a little nervous about is some of the managed care requirements that are coming back, or the gatekeepers, where mm-hmm. we've gone to become direct access autonomous providers, but there are some insurance plans now that are requiring referrals from primary care physicians or more medical management. And so that's detrimental. That's going backwards a little bit.
So is there anything that can be done to push towards more direct access and not having that extra step in between?
Mm-hmm. So the biggest thing there is we need to continually to show the value of physical therapy. Mm-hmm. And there are some programs called value-based insurance where things that are lower cost and high value, like physical therapy versus right. surgery or opiates. And so we have to continue to have research and to go through like the APTA registry and things like that, which will show that. The opiate problem is terrible. It's awful. Right. People are dying, you know, getting addicted to opiates and everything. But in a way, it's also an opportunity to show the value of physical therapy, because mm-hmm. now people are listening and saying, you know, maybe opiates
there's another way to there's deal another with way to control pain.
Yes, exactly. So as physical therapy is shown as a high-value, lower-cost alternative mm-hmm. and a healthier alternative to managing chronic pain or even acute pain after surgery. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe somebody doesn't need opiates right after surgery. They need a physical therapist to come see them to manage their pain and swelling and get their movement and function and get back going quicker. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be an opportunity to show the value of physical therapy, help grow the profession, and also help a lot of people who are suffering now because of addiction and things like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I know, like, there are so many different healthcare providers that can, you know, make a really big difference in terms of preventative care, but in some ways, we especially are able to do that, right? And that preventative care model is, one, a lot healthier for our society, and two, a lot less costly. So how do you see our progress towards moving that preventative care? Obviously, it might be a little slower than some countries. Where do you see us as a country moving towards that? And what are some of the more exciting changes in that direction?
These are great questions. And again, something close to home. Health and wellness and prevention are essential. It's
right.
it's the most cost-effective way to manage health conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I originally got involved, I tell you, I said I had a master's in public health, and it's also a degree in preventive medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned early on, and I learned it from treating individuals with brain injuries, and I got involved with motorcycle helmets and seatbelts. And mm-hmm. so, because I learned that the best way to treat a brain injury or an individual who has a brain injury is to prevent it, mm-hmm. you know, is not to have it caused in the first place. So
right.
to wear seatbelts, to wear motorcycle helmets, to wear ski helmets and those mm-hmm. type of things. But also, we can also help with prevention by having people work on better posture, better strength and flexibility, and going into activities, whether it's the ski season, by being stronger and more flexible, to teaching people how to ergonomically sit better and have better posture in their work environment, and how to lift and bend and those type of things. So
absolutely.
That's all the prevention type of areas. And of course, when it comes to the obesity epidemic, that's another area where physical therapists can help with, whether it's kids or adults, but help to not just lose weight, but to increase physical activity. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, controlling weight is two sides. You want to decrease intake, and there's dieting and healthy eating and the nutrition side, and then there's the physical activity side by increasing your activity. It's a mm-hmm. seesaw, it's a teeter-totter, and
right.
if you increase one, decrease the other. So we have a large role in improving the physical activity of society, and we can do that by working with individuals, or we can do that with working with communities by doing, you know, classes to working in the environment, helping parks become more accessible, coming up with ideas that can mm-hmm. allow people to walk and move and ride bicycles and improve their overall activity that way. So I think that's an opportunity. The biggest challenge we have with all these type of public health prevention programs is getting paid. And a lot of those
Absolutely.
Things are through the public health department. But again, if we had more of kind of a universal insurance program and a better public health system, then physical therapists can tie into that and be compensated for the time that they give with that. Right now, we get paid for treating patients, so we tend to work more at the individual level.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to see that change. The whole push to what we call population health is to try to move away from just treating individuals,
but treating
communities
whole,
and
right.
populations. And clearly going into schools and health clubs and things like
that.
That
was going to be my
like
next
that.
Question.
Yeah.
Currently, I mean, most of the physical therapists employed by public schools are working with kids who have developmental disabilities. But do you see that changing anytime soon where there mm-hmm. are PTs employed by public school systems that are in there just, you know, advocating in regular health classes or whatever it is to provide that education piece at a very young age?
Yeah, that's great. And again, the complication is the cost. And
right.
and in some ways, even though we feel we're not paid well enough, and I support that, especially mm-hmm. students coming out with high loans and things like that. In some areas, they think we're too expensive, you know. So,
right.
you know, that's where personal trainers and athletic trainers and fitness individuals work at a lower quote rate than physical therapists. But I still think there's a place for us in those environments, especially in the school, maybe as mm-hmm. consulting, and maybe not running the physical activity programs, and there are PE teachers and other people who can do that. And
right.
as you said in the beginning, there's a lot of competition, a lot of people who do that work in that area. But we have a place because we have specific expertise in the medical conditions of individuals, the medical background, interacting with the patient, with the client, not just as a patient, but as a person who has a complex history.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can give input in how to develop and set up a program that is safe and effective for their condition.
Absolutely.
You know, a child who's obese also has some joint problems, and maybe we need to evaluate that before they just get put on a physical activity program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I say a lot, I mean, personal trainers and people in fitness studios and are excellent at what they do, athletic trainers, but they tend not to be as comprehensive as physical therapists. You know,
right.
they, you know, when you go to a gym, they don't ask your medical history. They don't take your blood pressure. They don't...
it's like getting the full piece, all
exactly.
pieces of the puzzle.
Right, right. So they say, this is how to exercise, this is how this equipment works, and they're very skilled at that. But I think we can offer a much more comprehensive and safe and effective program.
Absolutely. So I know, I'm not sure actually if incoming students are aware of this, but each state has its own practice act, right? So that means that any state you move to, you will have to be licensed in that state, and that has its own rules. So do you believe that that is a positive or a negative thing, that each state has its own practice rate? And what do you believe the impact of having a single national practice act could be?
Okay, that's a great question, and it gets also very complicated in long history, and I can start talking about the whole federalist system of our country, you know, where we have states that have individual powers and controls and state legislatures. So mm-hmm. to do things nationally, it doesn't seem to make sense, but it's kind of the way our systems are set up.
Right.
So states like to have control over certain activities, including something as simple as a driver's license. Remember, mm-hmm. there's no national driver's license. You have to get a driver's license in every state. So state licensure of healthcare providers are continued that way.
Mm-hmm.
Insurance is regulated at the state level. Even though Medicare is a national program, there's still different in each state. And part of it is history and philosophy, but part of it is also, you know, we're a big country
mm-hmm.
and very diverse, and things are different. And things in the Southeast may not be the same as things in the Northwest. And so states are allowed to regulate that. Sometimes it gets frustrating when you say to a physical therapist, well, you could do dry needling in Colorado, but you can't do manipulation in Washington or something like that. But it's up to the individuals in that state to convince the state to say why we should be doing that. And so I actually support the state model, because I think doing things on a national level would kind of make it too easy to be kind of the same across, and it may not respond to the local
needs
or the local environment or things like that. It doesn't mean we can't coordinate things. So I use mm-hmm. the driver's license as an example. Yes, each state you have a driver's license, but at least that driver's license is good in every other state. And we call those compacts.
Right.
And so now we're working towards licensure compacts. And that'll be the way to deal with that. So you don't have to have a license in every state, but if you have a license in Colorado and Colorado has a compact agreement, eventually, hopefully, with every state, just like a driver's license, you don't have to take another test when you go into another state.
Right.
You're still licensed in the first state, but your license is useful there. And that's what the way we should go with the compacts. The problem is that, you know, just like speed limits are different in every state, you know, there are different scopes of practice that are different. But I think we're moving along with that. I mean, I use the example of dry needling and manipulation, but there's a few states that are different, but we're actually now coming along where those practices and the scope of practice is the same. And as PT expands its scope of practice with direct access, now that we have direct access in every state, ordering of imaging, and again, dry needling and manipulation and telehealth and things like that, we'll see the practice benefits more consistent from every state. But I think the national license is probably it's not going to happen.
Right.
And I don't know if it's the best thing. We can work around the state things by smoothing out some of these areas of inconsistencies.
Do you, because you mentioned the dry needling, obviously there are some populations that might benefit from it quite a bit that maybe aren't, you know, they don't have access to it because it's just not, it's not something that happens in that state. How do you see that like changing if people don't even have access to those kinds of services that they might need and they don't know that they need yet?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, now maybe you touched on something we could talk about is social media.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that things are much more transparent, and what we like to say, the world is flat, the country is much flatter than it used to be. In other words, communication is much quicker, you know. So if something becomes popular like dry needling, it spreads very quickly.
Sure.
And there'd probably be very little places in the country where somebody would say, well, I never heard of that, because that just doesn't exist anymore, you know, because everybody's on social media and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so when an NFL football player, you know, after the game says, and I heard Peyton Manning say this one time, saying, well, I have to go get my needling, you know. So, I mean, that just goes out to millions of people all over the country. And then
all of a sudden people
go, what's this needling? What's this dry needling? And, you know, we saw that with cupping. Remember during the Olympics, people were getting cupped and everything. Now, that mm-hmm. wasn't such a great thing, but it took off really quickly. So, you know, I think, you know, the Oxford debates talked about social media, and there's clearly some concerns we can talk about social media, but the good thing is it educates people and spreads information very quickly, and overall I think that's good.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually an excellent lead in into the Oxford debate, uh-huh. which is so Dr. Gorman attended the next conference last week in Chicago, correct? And there was a debate about social media's role, whether it was hazardous or helpful, and how its role has become increasingly large in the last few years. Mm-hmm. So can you touch on some of the discussion points there as far as...
So the Oxford debate is, you know, is a old English tradition of having a debate on a topic, and it can get very colorful and people dress up and it, you know, it's a serious topic but presented in a fun manner. And the whole idea is that you have the audience involved, and so audience sits on one side or the other, and when people make points, audience members run from one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the decision of who wins the debate is really based on the audience and things like that. But the things that we heard, and again, the team against it was dressed up in hazmat suits, and they said social media is hazardous to your health.
Right.
And the team that was for it you know, brought up the ideas of, as we said, about the ability to share information, the ability to educate people and share good things. And the group against it, of course, was concerned about the inability to monitor it,
right,
you know, to not regulate it, to not be able to have any kind of peer review or anything. So things get out there. And
which
so,
basically kind of sullies the name of PT if it...
It does, right, because, you know, sometimes somebody can say something good or bad about it. I mean, you know, it's just like any use of social media.
Right.
I just believe that things could be regulated, but, you know, the cat is out of the bag, so to speak, and you're not going to put the genie back in the bottle, so we're not going backwards, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's how to use it responsible. I mean,
right,
you know, I believe in moderation on a lot of things. You know, there are things that are good and bad, but if you do it too much, it could be too much of a good thing is bad too. So I think we just have to kind of be responsible and regulate it and ask questions. You know, we need to be critical thinkers and critical consumers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you hear something or see something, you have to ask questions and say, as opposed to say, oh, you know, I saw this and the results were, you know,
absolutely
amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's been on TV for years, too. I mean, there's always commercials I watch on TV going, oh, that can't be true, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think social media just brings it closer to home a little bit, because instead of now watching it on TV, you watch it on your phone and anytime, 24/7. So I think the response was, you know, back and forth and fun, and, you know, they gave the bad examples of social media when people, you know, go online and do things and that don't make any sense and everything. But I think overall, I think people felt it's here to stay, and we just need to be responsible about it.
So what is the best way to use it now
right.
that it is being used?
Yeah. And there's no question that as new graduates, you will have access to information that, you know, I had to go to the library to get or to open a textbook, and now you can
there's
get it
an
off
abundance.
Your phone. Right. And that's good.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you have access to information much faster and much quicker, and most of it is accurate, but we have to understand that not all of it is, so to be critical.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this gets a little bit complicated, but, you know, when you look at local fitness classes, there's a huge social component of putting people into a group and allowing them to discuss their own, whatever problems they might be having, their progress with something. Do you see social media ever being utilized to connect people who, you know, who do want to seek out, you know, some form of group, almost discussion about whatever they're going through? And do you see that being a beneficial thing for physical therapy?
Absolutely. So we've had support groups and things like that for years. In fact, I became very involved in work with individuals with traumatic brain injury through brain injury support groups, where I used to go and talk to, because I had young people in the hospital who suffered catastrophic brain injuries, and then I'd see the effect on their families and friends. So, you know, support groups were a really important part of that.
Right.
So I think, again, we've just now made it easier, because social media allows people to have virtual support groups to connect with people in much quicker and easier. There's also people that are not sociable, you know, social in the sense of they're not extroverts and maybe more introverted, and they may respond better online talking to somebody
than coming
to a group. Right. So I think there's only positives of that way. Of course, is it subject to misuse and abuse? Could people to be taken advantage on that? Yes, you know, and we have to be careful that way. But I think it opens the door and opportunity for more people to get peer support and professional support and things like that. So I think it's a positive thing. And it's part of, you know, again, what we do as physical therapists, you know, and we can support people to connect in different ways. I'm a social person. I believe in social connections. So,
oh, I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, I can only say when I was applying to PT school, how many different forums had popped up on different mm-hmm. social media sites that connected people who were in the same position, or maybe people who were going back and offering up their advice. Mm-hmm. And of course, taking everything with a grain of salt is incredibly yeah. important.
As long as you keep that in mind, I think then it's good. You know, it's mm-hmm. just, you know, as I say, be critical, be a critical thinker in everything you do. You know, mm-hmm. we teach critical thinking about patient decisions and treatment, but I think you need to be a critical thinker in everything you purchase, everything you do, schools you decide to go to, and I think that's good. Yeah, mm-hmm. So I'm glad.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, there was a group for active doctor of physical therapy, like mostly recent grads, and it's, I think, for people especially who, you know, are seeking out mentorship and seeking out a lot of collaboration in those initial first years of practicing with maybe a little bit more uncertainty. It's a really mm-hmm. nice forum to be able to collaborate and get a little bit more support.
Yeah.
So,
and we used to make the joke, you know, with the TV show, phone a friend. Well, now you do, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be in a clinic and you can, you know, go online and ask some advice and things like that, you know, again, mm-hmm. with confidentiality restrictions and things like that. But there's no reason why you can't ask somebody for advice on a certain patient condition.
Absolutely.
Or something, and get some information and get to be steered to where you can get some more positive information. So mm-hmm. I think that's good. Yeah.
So I think we'll just talk about one more of the discussions that happened at the next conference, okay. which is Excellence in the Cards. And that was just a discussion about ways in which our profession can enhance clinical and academic excellence, in addition to the feasibility of expecting physical therapists to modify their practice habits. Just what is when there's so much evidence that kind of it overwhelms the demands that like change is necessary. So and we've talked so much about what do you think PTs can do better, what can the profession do better, but overwhelming takeaway points from that discussion.
So this was extremely close to home, as mm-hmm. you may know. Tom McPoyle, who retired from Regis last year, mm-hmm. was the Mary McMillan lecturer. So he gave the talk.
Oh, how wonderful.
So a lot of us went there because we wanted to see Tom. We nominated him for this position. It's a great honor. This is the 50th Mary McMillan, so mm-hmm. it's one person a year who gets this opportunity. So I was just very proud to sit there and to support my former colleague, mentor and friend, Tom McPoyle, who did a great job. Mm-hmm. Tom had taught for years, has a number of, you know, over 100 publications, is considered an international expert on the foot and ankle. So mm-hmm. he has a lot to offer and a lot of wisdom and experience. Mm-hmm. But what he talked about is just basically that we have to strive for excellence, but are we always performing excellence? Mm-hmm. And he used some examples in his previous work about the foot and how there was a model of how to assess and evaluate the foot, what we called subtail and neutral, and that it was done for years by people because it was developed by two podiatrists, and it became the standard. And then since then, there's been a number of research by Tom and others that showed that it was not a very accurate measure, and it wasn't
right.
important to be done, and orthotics didn't need to be made based on that. It wasn't very reliable. When two people would measure it, they'd get different results, and if a measure's not reliable, then it really can't be valid. So so he proved that, and yet he finds that people are still doing that. So mm-hmm. that's where his question was, is, you know, when there's evidence out there, why aren't we paying attention to it? And so what drives people to not take into account decisions? Is it they're not reading the literature? Is there too much literature? Is it confusing? Are we just stuck in old habits and it's very hard to change? And then some of it, he said, is also not paying attention to historical literature. You know,
right.
So he wrote an original paper that described that problem with subtail and neutral in 1995. And yet in 2015, people were still questioning that and looking for more evidence. And if you say, well, there's evidence back in 1995, people tend to say, well, that's old.
Well, that's too, yeah.
But old doesn't mean bad, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can always improve on it, and it's good to replicate research and going forward, but we need to pay attention to what was done back then and say, you know, if this is a good study and this is what's been proven, then we should pay attention to it. So I think he challenged that we don't have this institutional amnesia of, you know, just doing things in a certain way and not paying attention to what had been done in the past.
Right.
And so he made people think about that and to really to say, you know, if we're going to become excellent, then we need to, you know, pay attention to previous information and to question things and to change our behaviors based on what the evidence says we should.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard thing to do. You know, a lot of people do things out of habit and comfort.
Right.
And when you've been doing something for a long period of time and somebody comes along and says, you know, that's not true, we kind of dig in, you know, we're afraid to change our beliefs.
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah. So,
do you believe that, you know, PTs maybe who are practicing with these methods that aren't quite so ideal, is that really something that is caught by insurance or caught by providers? Is it one of those things that, unfortunately, no one is noticing that the best treatment wasn't being used?
Mm-hmm. Well, first let me say, it's not just PT, you know.
Like, right, so, it's
medicine,
yeah.
Surgeons have been doing this for years, too.
Mm-hmm.
Physicians prescribe medications that, you know, have been shown not to be effective or certain treatment regimens, and they just don't change because that's the way they were taught and trained. And as I said, people don't like to give that up.
Mm-hmm.
Surgical procedures are done that may not be effective. And,
right.
And it's not always about money and greed. It's just habit. You know, people mean well. You
and
know?
Personal belief.
Right,
you
personal
know that
belief,
trumps.
Yeah. So it's not like they're just discounting it. It's just, you know, they mean well. So unfortunately, insurance probably doesn't become the gatekeeper as much as it should be. I think
mm-hmm.
we're seeing a little bit more where they're asking for the term medical necessity or evidence-based practice. So they're
right.
saying, what's the evidence for this? And we see that now with certain payers where they say, before this can be done, we have to have this done. Before this surgery can be done, you should have an MRI that shows that there's really a problem well before it just used to be done. The question is that extra time and money worth it? Because then you just increase healthcare costs and things like
right.
that. So we have to be fair about that. You know, I mean, before somebody treats somebody with a certain problem, a back problem, should they have an MRI? And when sometimes that actually steers people in the wrong direction. So, you know, we don't want to cause more healthcare costs to prove the evidence, but we also want to be honest about what we're doing and make sure that there's evidence to support that.
Absolutely.
So I think it's changing. You know, I think physical therapy is in a change where we went to the DPT 20 years ago, but there's still a lot of people without DPTs. You know, I think we're going to go through an evolution over the next 10, 20 years where the people practicing will be very different than previous. And as
Absolutely.
Older people leave the profession, that's good sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we don't want to lose the wisdom and the institutional memory and things like that we talk
Absolutely.
About. But we also want new young people who are trained and educated in a certain fashion to step up and take the place
mm-hmm.
of individuals too.
So. And I know you mentioned that abundance of research that exists, and I think for some practicing PTs, that's not a form that they're overly comfortable with. So do you feel like the continuing education aspect of the PT profession, does that adequately cover some of these new advancements, or could
mm-hmm.
that be improved upon
yeah.
as well?
So I believe the creation of the DPT was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are some people that are concerned about that. Did it increase
right.
education costs and is it really worthwhile? But I think it is for a couple of reasons. One, there was a tremendous amount of new information that needed to be delivered. And
mm-hmm.
if people are going to be in school longer, you should get a higher degree. There's also a kind of a quest for learning. When you have a doctoral degree, you really feel obligated to continue to learn and to be up to date. And
Absolutely.
I think there's a little bit more responsibility that people will take.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we have continued competency now with a lot of states that didn't have that before. Colorado now has continued competency, and it didn't for years. So,
mm-hmm.
and not just continuing education, but competency. So you have to show that you're improving and learning and staying up to date. And so that will be important.
For people who aren't familiar with that, is that a written test, or how does that work?
You know, it could be. Colorado made a choice not to relicense. In other words, not to take an exam again.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to go through every 2 years to show that you've taken courses or information and you've assessed yourself. So now when you go to a continuing education course, there has to be a certificate that says these are the objectives, this is the qualifications of who taught it, and this is an assessment that was done, whether it is the form of a test at the end of the class or something. So you only get credit for certain types of courses.
I see.
You can do a self-reflection and where you have certain goals and you say this is the courses I've taken. So it becomes a much more deliberate activity rather than just signing up for courses. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Colorado has done. Some states may go to retesting, just right. like the specialty exams have done. If you're orthopedic certified specialist, after 10 years, you have to take an exam again. So we may do that. You know, mm-hmm. certain healthcare providers do that as well. But we're at least moving in the direction where there's something, and I think that's right. important. But I think people are going to just stay up to date and much more current. It's also much easier to get information, again, because of, you know, doing things online, or, you know, you don't have to go travel to sit a course. You could take a course virtually
right.
and still get, you know, online education. That's very good. So there's more opportunities and more ease to get information, and I think that'll improve people. And, you know, people are graduating now more attuned to it. You know, if you've been practicing for 30 years, you say, why do I have to go back and get a DPT? Or why do I have to take these courses?
I've seen all the success. Yeah. What yeah. is there to change?
And, right? you know, people do get good results. I mean, that's mm-hmm. the other thing. A person says, well, I've been successful. My patients are getting better. They're happy. Mm-hmm. Why do I have to change? And so that's a hard thing to kind of convince somebody as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to have to stop asking Alrighty. Questions or this is going to last forever.
Okay. But an hour. That's pretty good.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.